Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1997. The White Farmers of Zimbabwe.
Hello. A year ago, just after Mr. Clinton had rented out the bedrooms in the White House often enough and had sold enough cemetery plots in Arlington National Cemetery and had raked in enough well-laundered cash from Buddhist nuns and assorted Chinese gangsters to get himself reelected, he appointed an all-Jewish national security and foreign policy team to his cabinet. One member of this team claimed to have discovered that she is a Jewess only after she had been appointed Secretary of State. Perhaps the idea behind that little ploy was to convince the American public that Mr. Clinton hadn't realized he was appointing all Jews to the most important positions in his cabinet. Perhaps it was intended to fool the voters into believing that the president was free to appoint a Gentile to the top policy position if he wanted to, and that he thought he had appointed a Gentile as Secretary of State. I mean, Madeleine Albright's Jewishness would have become public knowledge anyway, because everyone but the voters already knew she was a Jewess. So why not make it seem like a big surprise to Mr. Clinton and throw the public off the scent? Anyway, now the Jewish foreign policy of the United States is out in the open for everyone to see. That policy, in brief, is to bully the whole world into line with Jewish interests, to make the whole world subservient to Jewish desires. It is to destroy national sovereignty wherever it exists and subordinate national wills to the United Nations, to the New World Order. More specifically, the Jewish policy in the Middle East has been to cripple or destroy any country which might stand up to Israel and block that country's continued expansion. That's why Iraqi children continue to die from malnutrition and lack of medicine as the Jews continue the United Nations embargo against Iraq. And the policy elsewhere in the world is to force democracy on every country, because democratic governments are more easily manipulated and controlled. They are subject to whoever controls the mass media, and therefore the attitudes and opinions of the voters, as well as the public images of the candidates for office. Unless Iraq needs her further malevolent ministrations, Mrs. Albright will be off to Africa this month to bully and bribe the various black-ruled countries there into line. She will tell them that unless they want to receive the Iraq treatment, they had better become more democratic. She will be taking this message to Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda, the Congo, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. There will be much blather about human rights and the like for the sake of the gullible TV-watching public back in the United States. One group whose human rights Mrs. Albright certainly will not be making much noise about when she is in Zimbabwe, however, will be the white farmers of Zimbabwe whose land is being seized by the government and given to blacks. If you remember, Zimbabwe used to be Rhodesia, and Rhodesia and South Africa were the only two civilized countries, the only two white-ruled countries in sub-Saharan Africa. When the former British Empire, during its period of crazed self-dismemberment after the Second World War, tried to turn what had been the self-ruling colony of southern Rhodesia over to black rule, the white colonists who had built the colony out of the jungle declared their independence and called their new country Rhodesia. That was 32 years ago, in 1965. the United Nations, prompted by Britain and the United States, immediately applied pressure to force the white Rhodesians to submit themselves to black rule. The white Rhodesians, outnumbered by more than 20 to 1 by black savages, held out against terrorist attacks and a United Nations embargo and continued to flourish. The Jews in the United States and Britain used their control of the mass media to pour a torrent of unremitting hatred on the white Rhodesians, just as on the white South Africans. It became absolutely the trendiest thing on university campuses for students and faculty to express their commitment to feel-good egalitarianism by demonstrating against white Rhodesians and white South Africans and calling for their universities to sell any investments in companies still doing business in those countries. Christian organizations followed the Jewish lead and sent money collected from their parishioners to black terrorist groups fighting to overthrow the Rhodesian government. This led to an ironic sort of justice when the black terrorists began butchering the white nuns and priests in the numerous mission schools the churches had set up in Rhodesia earlier, simply because these mission schools were the easiest and safest white targets for the black terrorists. Eventually, in 1976, a treacherous government in South Africa tried to gain favor with the Jews and take some of the international pressure off itself by throwing Rhodesia to the wolves. South Africa had been Rhodesia's principal trading partner and her only source of new arms, especially helicopters, since the UN embargo effectively cut her off from the rest of the world. Even after the South African government cut off the supply of arms, Rhodesians kept up the fight to maintain their independence and hold the black terrorists at bay, however. What finally destroyed Rhodesia was the same thing which later destroyed South Africa, and that was moral failure on the part of the white population. White Rhodesians were under unremitting attack by the Jew-controlled media everywhere, and to a lesser extent, by the Christian churches. But the Rhodesians failed to come to grips with this. White Rhodesians needed to make a complete mental and spiritual break with the world of their enemies. They needed to set themselves against everything their enemies stood for. But they never dealt with the Jews and with the most treacherous elements in the Christian churches as enemies. Instead, they kept trying to ingratiate themselves with their enemies. They wanted to be accepted by their enemies. They wanted to be treated as good people by the Jewish media instead of as evil white racists. They were desperate to be fashionable again. They wanted to be loved by their enemies. They believed much of their enemies' propaganda against them. That is, they accepted the ideological premises of racial equality and democracy on which that propaganda was based. They denied that they were racists. And eventually, in 1979, their morale completely undermined by the enemy's propaganda. They voted to turn their country over to the black terrorists against whom they had been fighting quite successfully. With the blessings of the United Nations, the Jewish media, and the churches, the rule of the country was taken over by one of the black terrorist leaders, Robert Mugabe, in 1980, although the presidency had been formally given to a black cleric named, believe it or not, Canaan Banana. Later, terrorist leader Mugabe decided he could dispense with this formality and had the powers of the presidency vested in himself after Banana had disgraced himself by his flagrant homosexual behavior, which included the homosexual rape of one of the policemen assigned to guard the presidential palace. And for the last 17 years, the Whites of Rhodesia, which was renamed Zimbabwe after the handover of the country to Mugabe, tried to go on about their business of running their farms and hoping that the promises of the black government to respect their rights could be trusted. Now they found out that their hopes were in vain. Mugabe has designated approximately half of all the farmland in Zimbabwe owned by white farmers for seizure by his government without compensation. The white farms then will be divided up and given to former members of his terrorist army in return for their continued political support. The whites, of course, are quite distressed by this. Most of them have lived in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, all their lives, and everything they have is in their farms. They will be financially ruined by Mugabe's planned ethnic cleansing of Zimbabwe's farmland, and they will have nowhere else to go. Their laments have been largely ignored by the rest of the world because they are members of a politically incorrect race. And of course, the controlled media in Britain and the United States have been conspicuously quiet about this mass confiscation. About the only concern in the West seems to be over the likelihood that in taking the white farms, Mugabe eventually will hurt black Zimbabweans even more than he is hurting the white farm owners. Mugabe's move is very popular among blacks, of course, who have long resented the fact that Zimbabwe's tiny white minority owns half of all the good farmland in the country. But the white-owned farms have been producing virtually all of Zimbabwe's agricultural output and keeping a substantial portion of the country's blacks employed as farm workers. The half of the country's farmland currently owned by blacks is used only for subsistence farming and contributes nothing to the national economy. By taking half of the white farmland and giving it to blacks, Mugabe will be effectively cutting the gross national product of Zimbabwe in half and putting about 200,000 black farm workers out of work, amounting to about one out of every eight blacks currently holding a paying job of any sort in Zimbabwe. Furthermore, the prospects for foreign investment in Zimbabwe will be considerably dimmed by the confiscation, not to mention the prospects for the 1,500 or so white farmers temporarily allowed to keep their farms remaining in the country much longer. The present confiscation finally should teach them what they should have understood from the first, namely, that in the long run it is not feasible for whites to lead a normal, healthy, productive life under black rule. Now, the dilemma for the white liberals in Britain and America is that they want very much for countries like Zimbabwe to be successful and prosperous. They want Zimbabwe to be a proof to the world that a black-ruled country can be stable and viable. They need this to prop up their claims of racial equality. And they understand that if Mugabe kicks out his tiny minority of white farmers, Zimbabwe's economy will collapse. They understand it, but they can't admit it publicly. I mean, how does that look? A country of 11 million blacks being propped up by the activity of just 3,000 white farmers. The liberals and the Jews know that if the land of those white farmers is given to blacks, the land no longer will be productive, and the country's economy will collapse. They know that the blacks simply will not be able to run the farms efficiently and productively. They know it, but they dare not admit it. So, this is what Mrs. Albright will do. She will try to persuade Mugabe, quietly and privately, to hold off on his confiscation of white farms. She probably won't succeed in that because Mugabe is already fully committed to the confiscation, And if he changed his mind now, he might face a revolution from his disappointed followers. So next, Mrs. Albright will promise to bail out the Zimbabwean economy with U.S. foreign aid. The U.S. taxpayers will keep Mugabe propped up after the white farmers of Zimbabwe have been kicked out. But Mugabe will have to promise Mrs. Albright that in return for the U.S. aid, he will allow his government to be a little more democratic and a little more responsive to the directives from the United Nations. That's the way things were done back during the Cold War, when American taxpayers supported dozens of non-viable little third world outfits posing as countries in order to keep them from collaborating with the Soviet Union. Now the same racket is being used to bribe into line with the New World Order those countries which can't be bullied into line. The really clever thing about Mrs. Albright's racket is that it compels us to finance our own destruction. Most of the American taxpayers who will be taxed to keep Mugabe's Zimbabwe afloat with U.S. foreign aid will believe that, much as they dislike paying taxes, foreign aid is a necessary thing because it makes the world safer and more stable. The United Nations, they believe, is a good thing because it helps prevent wars. They don't stop to think that it was United Nations policy which caused the present situation in Zimbabwe. It was United Nations pressure and hostility. It was the United Nations embargo which helped persuade the white Rhodesians to surrender their country to Mugabe and his terrorists in 1979. No matter how much United Nations spokesmen may protest that they didn't intend for things to work out this way, it was United Nations policy which has led to the dispossession of the white farmers of Zimbabwe and the resultant need to prop that country up economically. White Rhodesia never needed a handout from anyone. Now the whites of Rhodesia are being destroyed, and we, the white taxpayers of America, will pay for the consequences of this. And Mrs. Albright and her devious clan will continue their manipulations, supposedly to make the world a safer place for democracy, but actually to make a basket case out of the world so that it can be more easily controlled. Let me give you an important hint. When trying to understand what the Jews are up to, you look at what they are doing and what they have done. You don't listen to what they tell you they plan to do. You don't let yourself be distracted by the patter and the hand-waving. You keep your eye on the shell which has the pea under it. You don't let yourself be fooled by all the blather about democracy and human rights and international security. You just keep your mind on the fact that United Nations policies always have resulted in our people being killed or dispossessed, with the Rhodesians being merely the latest example. And also, just remember that when a country like Iraq ignores United Nations directives, we go to war to make it obey. And to punish it for its independence, we enforce embargoes which result in hundreds of thousands of its children dying. But when Israel ignores United Nations directives, nothing happens. Absolutely nothing. Understand? And I'll give you another hint. The Jews aren't able to get away with leading the world around by the nose because they're better looking than we are, or because they can talk faster. It's not even because they're smarter than we are, and they are fairly smart on the average. No, the reason they were able to persuade Mr. Clinton to choose an all-Jewish foreign policy team is because they are better organized than we are. They know how to act as a group. And the reason they are able to use the United Nations for their own ends is that they know what those ends are. They know what they want as a people, and they are organized as a people for getting it. They are able to use their control of the mass media to promote their interests as a people, because they are able to subordinate their private interests as individual businessmen to their group interests as Jews. Keep that in mind as the news reports come in from Africa about Mrs. Albright's diplomatic mission there. And you know, there's only one way we can beat this racket, and that's for us to begin thinking about our own interests as a people, and putting those collective interests, those racial interests, ahead of our private interests. We must learn to be as concerned about the interests of our people in Rhodesia as anywhere else in the world. And we must discipline ourselves as a people so that when the Jews begin using their media to persuade the trendy airheads among us to demonstrate against any segment of our people, as they organize them against the white Rhodesians and the white South Africans, we have the means to knock some sense into the airheads. We must have the discipline to act as a people and to keep any foolish or selfish segment of our people from collaborating with our enemies with impunity. And finally, we must use our collective strength to build our own mass media, our own means for communicating with our own people, instead of permitting the Jews to maintain their virtual monopoly of the media and to continue to mislead and confuse our people. That's what these American Dissident Voices programs are all about. They're a start toward getting our media back into our hands. Thanks for being with me again today.